VOA News reporting by remote, I'm Michael Brown. U.S. President Joe Biden on Thursday announced a new six-point plan to combat the surge in recent weeks of Delta variant coronavirus cases and deaths, including sweeping vaccine mandates and other measures. Biden ordered federal workers and contractors, workers in most hospitals and healthcare settings, and any employee of a company with more than 100 workers to be vaccinated against the coronavirus as part of a new effort to control the infectious disease. It was not immediately clear Biden's order covering federal workers and contractors would allow for exemptions for those seeking religious or medical exemptions from vaccination. Some companies are already requiring their workers to get their vaccinations or lose their jobs. The Los Angeles Board of Education has voted to require students 12 and older to be vaccinated against the coronavirus if they attend in-person classes in the country's second largest school district. The board's vote Thursday makes Los Angeles by far the largest of any very number of districts with a vaccine mandate. Under the plan, for Los Angeles students 12 and up who participate in sports and extracurricular activities need to be fully vaccinated by the end of October. The Taliban authorities allowed a Qatari charter flight to leave for Doha from Kabul Airport on Thursday, the first flight for evacuees to take off since the United States ended its military operation in Afghanistan on August 31st. Media outlets reporting the flight carried 113 passengers, among them 43 Canadians, 13 Dutch nationals. For more news, please join us on our website, voanews.com, or the VOA mobile app. Via remote, this is VOA News. The UN Special Envoy for Afghanistan is urging the world to unite to prevent the economic collapse of the country, to address fears the Taliban's Islamic State may spread to its neighbors and to fight terrorism. Deborah Lyons told the UN Security Council Thursday the Taliban have visibly welcomed and sheltered al-Qaeda members and that Islamic State extremists remained active and could gain strength. Hong Kong police charged the group that organized the city's annual candlelight vigil marking the 1989 Tiananmen crackdown and three of its leaders with subversion under the new national security law. Two of the leaders of the Hong Kong Alliance in Support of Patriotic Democratic Movements of China are already serving jail terms for their roles in unauthorized protests in 2019. The third leader, together with four others who were arrested this week, were also charged with failing to comply with the requirement to provide information for a national security investigation. Police on Thursday raided the closed June 4th museum, which was run by the Alliance to commemorate the bloody Tiananmen Square crackdown in Beijing in 1989, and confiscated computers and documents from that venue. Well, the U.S. government is suing the southwestern state of Texas to try to block its new law that bans abortions in the state after about 6 weeks of pregnancy, the most restrictive anti-abortion statute here in the U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland said the Justice Department is bringing the lawsuit against the country's second largest state as a duty to uphold the rule of law. He said all provisions of the law concerned him. The U.S. Supreme Court on a 5-4 vote last week allowed the law to take effect, a decision praised by anti-abortion advocates looking to eventually overturn the court's landmark 1973 decision declaring that women in the United States hold a constitutional right to have an abortion. President Joe Biden warned that the law would cause unconstitutional chaos because it gives private citizens rather than the government the right to enforce it by filing civil lawsuits against people who help women obtain an abortion after 6 weeks, whether it be a doctor who performs the procedure or someone who drives a woman to a clinic. Law allows people winning such lawsuits to collect at least $10,000 and makes no exceptions in case of rape or incest. For more news, please join us, voanews.com or the VOA mobile app. I'm Michael Brown, reporting by remote, VOA News.
Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Mpate in Washington. Today is Friday, September 10th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Guinea's military junta considers a transitional process.
The organization of the transition has started seeing some actions taken in that sense. Consultations have started already.
A Guinean opposition politician says he will return from exile tomorrow, Saturday. Nigeria's president calls on Igbos to embrace their Nigerian citizenship. Ethiopia says its forces defeated Tigrayan rebels in the country's Afar region. And Uganda's president denies he's grooming his son to succeed him.
His statement or his denial about his son being prepared or groomed as a successor is of no consequence with regard to what may be being done to achieve that objective.
And the East Africa community faces health challenges. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley Sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Opposition politician says he has seen signs that the process of putting together a transitional administration following the military takeover might have begun. Fayyami Limono, leader of the opposition Liberal Bloc Party, says the military junta led by Lieutenant Colonel Mamadi Dumbuya has started seeing some politicians apparently to talk about putting together a transitional administration. But Limono says he personally would not serve in the transitional administration, but his party would if asked. A delegation from the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, was supposed to have traveled to Guinea on Thursday, but Milimulo says it was not clear on Thursday if the delegation had arrived.
I tried to get information about the coming of that delegation from the ECOWAS, but what I read this day is that they have postponed the program to come to Guinea.
So what's the latest in Guinea now?
In Guinea, the latest is the organization of the transition. We have started seeing some actions taken in that sense. Consultations have started already because there is at least one political leader who has visited the junta. So at this time, as we speak, you have contact, you have consultations. Most importantly, we have succeeded to have many of political prisoners to be free. And that is one of the biggest news here. And it was done properly. Hundreds of them are living with their family as we speak.
Talking about the prisoners, have you had a chance to meet with any of them or debrief them or talk to any of the released prisoners?
I have met with some of them, and I have an appointment to meet with some other even tomorrow, just to show the support to them, to encourage them.
You said, Mr. Milimuno, that the military junta has begun meeting with some politicians. If they asked to meet with you to serve in a transitional government, would you consider that?
First, we haven't had any invitation about that. My political party belongs to the coalition. We have made a statement saying that we will be fully involved in the conduct of that transition. But so far, we haven't had any direct meeting with them. We have ideas to put on the table, so we're waiting for an occasion to just do that.
So you would, you have some ideas to put on the table, including even that you would be willing to serve if they ask you to?
My political party will be willing to serve. As far as myself, it will depend. So as the leader of the party, I am not the person to decide if there is a need for one person or two people of my political party to belong to any body of that transition. It will be the party to make the decision.
Thank you for everything.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Fayyami Limono is the leader of the opposition Liberal Bloc Party of Guinea. He was speaking with us from the capital, Conakry. In Guinea, the leader of the opposition Republican Forces Party says he will return to Guinea tomorrow, Saturday, from exile, now that President Alpha Condé is no longer in power. Sidya Touré fled to Ivory Coast last October after first alleging that police prevented him from leaving the country and seized his travel documents. Now, Touré says he's happy to return home. He says the military overthrow of President Condé was justified.
I think it's a very good thing. You know, this guy has the worst governance I've ever seen in my life. Guinea is second exporter for bauxite. We are iron, diamond, so many things. You know, all the money coming from that, you know, we suppose for his 10 years is about $4 billion. He never built one hospital or one, I don't know, university or one stadium or, I don't know, 100 kilometers of road. We have a corruption, huge corruption. But from that, is putting everybody in jail. Many people die from this situation. And myself, I'm in exile because they try to kidnap me. This is the situation. This tension, you know, from the poverty we have in the country, bring this coup, because those young military live inside the country and live in town with the young people. Anyway, we knew what something will happen. We don't know if that happened last Sunday.
So you said you have been in exile. How long have you been in exile?
10 months. 10 months I'm here from Abidjan to Paris. I don't know, you know.
Wow. So now are you going to return to Guinea?
I'm going to return to Guinea Saturday, as I say, to discuss with militaries and try to have a possibility to organize a new election after the transition, you know. We'll go there to discuss it as well.
So if the military were to ask you to serve in a transition, would you?
No, I'm not going to serve in transition because I will be candidate, you know. I will run. So in this situation, people who are run are not serving in the transition.
So like other politicians in Guinea, you welcome the military takeover?
Absolutely, absolutely. This is only the best thing we can help happen to us this moment.
Mr. Touré, it's always very nice to talk to you. Get in touch with us when you get back to...
Okay, we'll talk for when I arrive in Conakry on Sunday and all the time.
Sidya Touré is the leader of the opposition Republican Forces Party of Guinea. He was speaking with us from Abidjan, Cote d'Ivoire. Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari Thursday visited Imo State in the southeastern region of the country, home to the Igbo people. The indigenous people of Biafra, led by Nnamdi Kanu, has been calling for an independent state for ethnic Igbos in southeast Nigeria. Kanu was arrested in July this year and charged with terrorism and treasonable felony, among other charges. Galba Shehu, senior special assistant to President Buhari on media and publicity, says the president delivered a message of a united Nigeria. He says President Buhari asked the Igbos to accept their Nigerian citizenship because there is no reason for any Igbo person to want to denounce his or her Nigerian citizenship.
President Muhammadu Buhari was in Imo State to commission major projects completed by the present administration in the state. And yes, after the commission of the projects, he attended a town hall meeting with the leaders of the southeast region.
As you know, Shehu, there has been some agitation from the Igbo people because they feel that their region has been marginalized. What was his main message to the people of the region?
The president's message is clearly one of unity of the country, that he has asked the leaders of the Igbo ethnic group to accept their Nigerian citizenship and belong, considering that the president, in his words, said the entire Nigerian economy is in the hands of the Igbos, and they are present in every part of the country doing businesses and running their lives as fellow citizens of Nigeria. So in his view, he does not see any reason why any Igbo person should aspire to leave Nigeria.
There have been suggestions for the president to release some people from the region who have been imprisoned. Did the president talk about that, to release some prisoners from that area?
No, the president did not make any mention of that. We are a democracy in Nigeria, and the courts are independent of the president. The president cannot dictate to the courts who to detain and who not to detain.
Some people have suggested or have alleged that the president made the trip to put his party, the APC, in a position for the coming elections. Was the president's trip about election politics?
The state he visited, Imo State, does not have an upcoming election until 2023. The election that is upcoming is in neighboring Anambra State. And if the president's wish is to campaign in election, the right state to have visited would have been Anambra. So I think this calculation is completely out of place.
Galba Shehu is the senior special assistant to Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari on media and publicity. He was speaking with us from the capital, Abuja. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, September 10. President Yoweri Museveni of Uganda has denied reports of an alleged succession plan that will ensure his first son replaces him as the country's leader after he retires. Known as the Muhuzi Project, there have been routine talks that the president plans to install Lieutenant General Muhuzi Kainerugaba as the East African country's next president to succeed Mr. Museveni. But President Museveni rejected the talks, saying Ugandans will decide who their next leader will be when he retires. Political analyst Gorbea Tumushabe, head of the Great Lakes Institute for Strategic Studies, tells viewers Peter Clotty that the president's denial is unlikely to end the speculations.
I don't think that there is any moment where the president would come out and say, I am grooming my son to be the next president. What probably your listeners should know, Peter, is that on this continent, this African continent, there is an axis of monarchical regimes that has been emerging over time, all of them military-based, right from Chad through Cameroon, through Equatorial Guinea, to Uganda, to Rwanda, that most of the sitting president, and these are presidents who have been in power for years, for decades, they all work to make sure that their children or their sons occupy positions that can lead them to the presidency.
So do you think that his latest denial will quench or stop the talks about a possible plan of succession that will allow his son to replace him if he retires? Because on social media platforms, people are suggesting that they would want his son to be the next president.
I can say categorically that his statement or his denial about his son being prepared or groomed as a successor is of no consequence with regard to what may be being done to achieve that objective. But as long as the president is not building institutions of state that then determine or that can guarantee that the citizens of Uganda are able to make choices, democratic choices on who should lead them, then he is creating the inevitability that either his son or someone he wants can be able to succeed him. For me, that's the way I look at it.
So, Godbear, what do you think necessitated these talks about possible succession? Because his son has kept a low profile in spite of the promotions he's had in the military. So what necessitated the talks of a possible succession?
Peter, this talk has been here for as long as probably now or close to two decades. In fact, after 2011... one of the senior military officers called General Sejusa, who was the coordinator of national intelligence, essentially published a dossier where he elaborated the entire plan on how the president was working to make his son to succeed him.
That was Gorbea Tumushabe, head of the Great Lakes Institute for Strategic Studies. He was speaking with viewers Peter Clotty from the Ugandan capital, Kampala. The Ethiopian government says rebel Tigrayan fighters have been defeated in the country's Afar region, a claim denied by the rebels, who called it a tactical withdrawal. Meanwhile, the Tigrayan People's Liberation Front has rejected reports that their fighters killed scores of civilians in neighboring Amhara region and called for an independent investigation. Gelmo Dawit reports from Addis Ababa.
Kasam Shishai, the mayor of Boken Town in northern Gondar, he says fighters with the TPLF targeted and killed civilians after losing battles to the Ethiopian army. He says, so far we have discovered the bodies of between 200 and 250 people. There are also some people who were taken away and they are still missing. He says, the attackers took most of the residents alive and assassinated them elsewhere. In our culture, we do not announce the deaths until we get the body of the deceased, so the number of the victim could be more. Meshesha says the killing happened between August 31st and September 2nd in Chennawad, in Dibat constituency of Northern Gondar district. Local residents held burial ceremony for loved ones in Chinnate Kleamanu Church. The Udukista told VOS Horn of Africa service that four relatives were among those killed. He says, I lost four brothers. Three of them are my siblings, while one of them belongs to my uncle. He also says the TPLF forces came and forced them to leave their home. Then they took their belongings like cattle, sheep, and burned their house. Lastly, they killed them all. He says, we are left with nothing now. Meshesha is concerned about the future of his village. He said the residents are left with few possessions and their future is in limbo. Their land has been turned into a graveyard, he says. They have buried their loved ones in their farm field, backyard, and even in the house as well. He says they are now roaming in town, losing hope. They have nothing to eat now and in the future as well. The Ethiopian Prime Minister's office and the Ethiopian Human Rights Commission have also blamed the Tigray People's Liberation Front for the killings and said they are conducting investigations. However, the TPLF, which has been fighting the Ethiopian government troops and forces from the Amhara and Afar regions, has dismissed the accusations. Spokesperson Gita Chureda wrote the TPLF's response on Twitter. The statement reads, the article written by Reuters news agency regarding the killing of 120 civilians in Amhara regions on 1st and 2nd of September 2021 is completely false. In the statement, the TPLF accused the Amhara region of fabricating the story and called for an independent investigation. Gelmo Dawit for VOA News, Addis Ababa.
East African community is experiencing healthcare service challenges. According to AMREF Health Africa and the Coalition for Health Research and Development, these challenges are made worse by vaccine hesitancy across the region due to misconceptions and misinformation. As Maureen Ojiambo reports from Milwaukee, USA, research in Kenya indicates that 4 out of 5 Kenyans believe that COVID-19 has affected the cost of health care.
According to AMREF Africa, a lot of progress has been made by various players within the public health space, including rapid development of tests, treatment, and vaccine against coronavirus. Speaking virtually, Dr. Meshack Ndirangu, country director, AMREF Kenya, said that despite vaccine availability in hospitals and other services, many people in East African region are hesitant to seek medical attention.
While these collective achievements remain commendable, there are serious challenges of vaccine equity and access currently affecting lower middle-income countries, including Africa and the East Africa region. These challenges are compounded by vaccine hesitancy among communities across the region as a result of misconceptions and myths fueled by misinformation.
Dr. Ndirangu says the Eastern African countries, the EAC Secretariat, African CDC, and WHO Afro have to mobilize influential community champions to help people access healthcare services and vaccines.
Because remember, the CRIP partnership is about how do we break barriers to access to effective medical and health technologies. And here we are today, we have a vaccine, and sometimes it's not accessible. Sometimes when it's accessible, there's no demand.
In South Sudan, civil societies are advocating for vaccine uptake as allegations of the country giving away vaccines donated to them come up, as health system is said to be struggling to contain the health crisis. Zabib Musaloro, Executive Director, Islamic Development and Relief Agency, has called on support to South Sudan.
How I wish UNRED and GRID would support South Sudan to understand and really take this COVID issue as a serious agenda. We have had the vaccine. We are lucky that we were given a dose of vaccine last year, but then it ended up being transported and given to Kenya because people did not show interest. So I'm just thinking loud and wanting to request for a direct support.
In an InfoTrack survey on healthcare system in Kenya, patients cited poor services and lack of health workers, with 9 out of 10 people saying doctors were absent in most government hospitals. InfoTrack research manager Walter Nyakundi said that hospital bill was expensive and most could not afford, as many resorted to selling their property. 53% of Kenyans who visited public health facilities between the end of 2020 and mid-2021 noted that they had inadequate resources such as medical equipment and drugs. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Milwaukee, USA.
For Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson Umale in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you too, James. We begin the sports with athletics, as Nigeria's Oluwatobilola Amusan became the first Nigerian athlete in history to win a Diamond League trophy on Thursday, storming to victory in the women's 100 meters hurdles in Zurich. Miss Amusan did it in style, shattering Gloria Alozie's African record of 12.44 seconds and running a new personal best, an African record of 12.42 seconds. Also in Zurich at the Diamond League finals, Namibian teenager Christine Mboma won the 200 meters, returning a time of 21.78 seconds. In other events, two-time Olympic champion Faith Kipyegon held off the Netherlands' Sifan Hassan to claim the 1,500 meters ahead of a thrilling home straight duo. There was another Kenyan victory in the men's race, as world champion Timothy Chiriot took some revenge for Jacob Ingebrigtsen's win in Tokyo, outlasting the Norwegian as they went 2-2 over the final 100 meters. And now to cricket news. The ICC Women's T20 World Cup Africa qualifier is two steps away from the World Cup on the road to South Africa 2023. Host Botswana, Eswatini, Mozambique, Rwanda, Tanzania, and Zimbabwe are all in Pool A, whilst Cameroon, Namibia, Nigeria, Sierra Leone, and Uganda will form Group B in the 11-team tournament to be played in Gaborone. The top two teams from each group will play in the semifinals before the two finals compete for the lone qualification spot to the Global Qualifier 2022 on September the 19th. Team Nigeria's 25-member contingent is led by Miriam Suleiman.
We don't really have any beach at all. In the camp, the spirit is very high. Our girls are at their top form, and then our expectation is that we are going to be victorious this time around.
For Uganda senior national women's cricket team coach Suraj Karavadra, preparations appear to be going so well.
We're making sure that we're keeping to our fundamentals, making sure we're doing the basics well, everything that we've practiced over the last sort of 5-6 weeks.
And now to tennis, where South African tennis player Lloyd Harris has said that he learned a lot from reaching the quarterfinals of the US Open, with his run ending on Wednesday. The 24-year-old lost in straight sets to Germany's number 4 seed Alexander Zverev in New York in what was his first appearance in the last 8 of a Grand Slam. And onto football news. The Ghana Football Association has successfully concluded its annual club licensing workshop for all elite clubs in the country. The workshop started on Tuesday, August 31st, 2021, with chief executive officers and club licensing officers of all 18 Premier League clubs in Ghana. And that's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Umale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good weekend. And that's it for this Friday, September 10th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all our engineers, I'm James Barton, Washington, wishing you a very good weekend.